This episode of Addiction, an Hour with Hour, is brought to you by Gaming Laboratories International. GLI is a world-class testing, inspections, and certification company committed to delivering the highest quality land-based, lottery, and iGaming testing and assessment services around the world. GLI provides suppliers, operators, and regulators with expert guidance for navigating the future of gaming and ensuring gaming innovations meet regulatory standards with confidence in more than 710 jurisdictions. For more information, visit GamingLabs.com. Hello and welcome to another episode of Addiction, an Hour with Hour. I am not Michael Hour, and I do not last an hour. I've been alive considerably longer than that. My name is John Bruford. I'm one of your hosts. We're joined by His Eminence, Dr. Michael Hour. Dr. Hour, hello.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm okay. Thank you. All the better for being in your company, obviously. Mm-hmm. You're also a healing kind of doctor. By your very presence.
Come again?
It's okay. I was lying through my teeth.
I know.
But fortunately, it's not just the two of us today. We are joined by another special guest. Because all of our guests are special, aren't they?
Some are more special.
Are any of them more special than you?
Maybe in a different way.
Okay. I bet you that author bloke, I bet you think he's more special than you, that one, you know.
Yeah, we won't talk about him.
Is that because you'll go all fanboy again? Dan Lieberman, that's the chap.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, I'm sure Rachel is aware of him.
Well, speaking of Rachel, it's as good a time as any to introduce our guest. Just to warn people, we are getting a tiny little bit of feedback on one of the microphones today, but it's not a big deal, so you can live with it. If you don't like it, suck it up. Don't be a little buttercup. We are joined by the magnificent Rachel Volberg, who is a retired research professor from the University of Massachusetts Amherst and president of Gemini Research. Rachel, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Michael.
I should say thank you for slumming it with us today. But whether you're slumming it with me or Michael or both of us is wide open to debate. So, Rachel, what's your... I said retired research professor at University of Massachusetts Amherst. That's like, even I know the name of that college, and like, I don't know much about anything, as you will learn quite soon. What was your bread and butter when you were there?
While I was at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, I was leading as principal investigator a very comprehensive study of the social and economic impacts of the introduction of casinos in Massachusetts. So this is a study that was mandated in the statute, the law that was passed legalizing casinos in 2011. And so the newly established Gaming Commission put out a request for proposals, and I assembled an international team, and we competed for the project and were awarded the contract. And the study lasted basically from 2013 until 2025. It was, as far as I know, it was the longest lasting and best funded study of the impacts of gambling ever done.
That is a long study. There are some kids playing just down the road, so you can probably hear them. I was just explaining to Michael, I haven't kidnapped any children. They're not screaming to escape. It's just some kids playing down the road. That's staggeringly long because, I'm trying to think. So I've been working in the casino industry for 20 years, I think. And I'm thinking, when I think of Massachusetts and gambling, my mind immediately goes to Boston Harbor and the big development.
Oh, there. Yes. Yeah, Encore Boston Harbor.
Thank you. Yes, Encore. Of course. I was trying to think because I think its naming came about when there were some allegations going on about. Yeah, and hence it became Encore Boston Harbor, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, it had
Wynn's name on it before that. It did. So how many casinos are we talking about in the state?
So the law that was passed in 2011 divided the state up into three regions, the eastern region, the western region, and the southeast region, which is sort of towards Connecticut and Rhode Island. And the southeast region has never actually gotten a full-scale casino. The Plainridge Park Casino that's at Plainridge Racetrack is actually only slot machine games. So that was the first one that opened in 2015. And then in 2018, MGM Springfield opened, which is over here in the western part of the state where I live. And then finally in 2019, the Encore Boston Harbor was finished and opened. And was open for approximately 6 months before COVID shut everything down. So one of the interesting things about the study that we did, which is called The Social and Economic Impacts of Gambling in Massachusetts, was that in addition to following or examining the impacts of the construction of the casinos and the operations of the casinos for their first years, we also were able to look at the impact of COVID-19 on gambling behavior in Massachusetts. And in 2022, when the state legislature passed sports betting, we were pulled into that particular arena and tasked with monitoring the early impacts of sports betting.
So quite accidentally, you've been doing this study in a really extraordinary period of time.
Yes, it's been extraordinary.
Because that's like, I mean, people ask me questions about the gambling industry all the time. And I, one of the remarkable things about the gambling industry, if you look solely at revenue, if you've got like, you've got Caesars and MGM and they've both got loads of properties in loads of places, but Wynn has like, I think seven properties, an eighth about to open up, and yet they're in the top three globally, which is extraordinary. They're very precise about what they do, which is why that Encore, I'm not going to say it seemed like a misstep. I don't doubt for one second they knew exactly what they were doing.
Well,
it stands out in their estate though.
Yeah, they ran into a major challenge in Massachusetts. The property originally was intended to attract international visitors, so people coming through Boston and radiating out across the United States. But I forget exactly the year that it happened, but it was during the course of the study. The Chinese government decided to crack down on corruption and prevent anybody from traveling overseas to gamble. And that was the main market that Encore Boston Harbor was aiming at, was, you know, Chinese travelers from China.
It had a similar effect. There was a casino in Saipan that, I'm not going to say it closed overnight, but it suddenly wasn't nearly as profitable.
So Encore had to pivot fairly early on and cater to more of a locals market.
It's not a bad locals market to have, though. It is one of the most significant cities in the U.S., and I think it has a reasonably affluent middle class.
Yeah. A lot of universities there, a lot of technology companies.
Boston. Great transport links.
Not if you're in Western Massachusetts.
Compared to a lot of American cities, it's got really good transport links.
Okay. I spent several years of my childhood or my teenagehood living in Europe. And so I got very, very spoiled with the availability of trains.
I think you told me, what was it, Switzerland? Or where did you go to school, Rachel?
Yeah, I was in boarding school in Switzerland for a couple of years at the end of high school. And actually, an earlier school, also in Switzerland, but another part of Switzerland over near Gstaad. My sister and I spent a year when we were, I want to say 10 and 11, and then we moved again back to the U.S.
That's an amazing time to be abroad. Like that's an amazing age to be abroad.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Do you think like an experience like that sort of affected your worldview as you became an adult?
Absolutely. But the other thing that you may not know about me is that I grew up from age 6 to 11. My mother and my sister and I actually lived in Ghana.
Wow.
West Africa. Yeah.
How did that come about?
My mother liked to travel. She and my father divorced when I was 3, and she was working for a company called Kaiser Engineers, which in 1961 was successful in getting the contract to build the Akasamba Dam, which is the dam that they built across the Volta River. And so a bunch of people came from Ghana to meet with the Kaiser Engineers. And my mother asked one of them for a job, and they were like, okay. And so we moved.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is. And a dam project. I mean, that's like...
My mom was actually not as closely involved with the construction of the dam as she was with the resettlement project, because there were 80,000 people that had to be moved out of the area that was going to be flooded behind the dam. And so the Ghanaian government essentially moved everyone out and gave them all housing.
Wow.
Yeah.
But I mean, you've seen things. I'm not dissing America or Americans. I'm a big fan. I think there's quite a large proportion of Americans, as there are with any big country. It's the same for Canadians, Chinese, especially Russians. But a reasonable proportion of Americans don't have a passport and have never left the US.
I've had a passport since I was 6.
I think you've traveled for most of them.
Yes, I've done a lot of traveling because, my mother traveled until she was about 80 by herself. When I got into gambling research, and which was in 1985, so 40 years ago, it was a period of time when you still had to travel to wherever the project was to, like, meet the people and figure out what the questionnaire was going to look like or whatever. And so I probably traveled once or twice a month for the first 25 years of my career.
What's your actual educational background, Rachel?
You mean as an academic or my academic background? Mm-hmm. I'm a sociologist. I'm a qualitatively trained sociologist.
Wow, nice.
And I got dropped on my head into survey research and had to learn statistics by using my interviewing skills.
Yeah, all right.
That sounds fun.
Yeah, as the statistician is like, what...
Actually,
what is a standard error? What does it mean?
Yeah. Well, I tell you, most people really read it wrongly. Anyway, I mean, if you go, if you would really t- take all of the statistical assumptions seriously, you know, like normal distribution, blah, 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 independence of observations. I would say probably you could flip the coin on any study's validity.
Yeah, but it was a good background to have for what I ended up doing.
Yeah, I wanted to you just mentioned sociology, and in the beginning you said, and that made me curious, right? So the study in Massachusetts, it's called the Social and Economical Impact of Gambling. And what do you think, like today, I mean, would they call it differently with, you know, the movement towards public health approach, you know, the focus on harm, gambling harm rather than problem gambling? Because, like, you know, the study's title doesn't mention psychology, it doesn't mention health or anything like that. But I assume in your...
Sorry, Michael, it does say social and economic impacts. Yeah. So social impacts was very much about problem gambling and impacts on communities. And then the economic side was really looking at the, you know, following the money around and trying to figure out where it was going, where it was coming from and where it was going.
That's also very interesting. I mean, I would say very few studies, I mean, in sort of, you know, our area, like, you know, the research of responsible gaming bothers about money, source of money, doesn't it? I mean, so what did you sort of, I mean, what were they, I mean, it's hard, you know, for sure to summarize, but what, in terms of the economic aspect, what's your verdict?
So it's important to understand that the statute, the legislation that legalized casinos, the Expanded Gaming Act of 2011, had many, many pieces to it that had to do with giving the host communities and the surrounding communities a voice in what was going to happen. So when we first started out in 2012, I guess, was when the Gaming Commission was stood up. You know, quite a lot of operators were like scouting around wanting to figure out a good community to build a casino. And what was, I think, most surprising to them was the host community had to have a referendum on whether the citizens, the residents of that community wanted a casino. And it was actually quite a number of communities that said, nah, we're not interested. Go play somewhere else. So we monitored all of those impacts, you know, all the early stuff, all the sort of the middle stuff. And then, you know, when COVID came along, we all retreated to our little offices at our homes and continued to work on the project there. But the economic impacts of casinos in Massachusetts are unusual because the operators set up Calyx, I can't talk, honey. I'm on a podcast. Bye. Sorry, my daughter.
We're gonna leave that in.
Can I tell you a funny story?
Go for it.
Sure.
So where was I? I was giving a talk, and I had put my phone over there, I laid it out on the table where we were presenting, and I was up and presenting. Oh, this was at the international conference. I was up and presenting, and my phone rang, and it was my daughter, and I recognized the ring, and I was like, can someone just hang up? That's my daughter. And the room just like fell apart laughing. She called it at the exact moment where I could not possibly answer my phone because I was standing, you know, like 30 feet away.
It's the gift that keeps giving.
It happens.
Yes.
Yes. It was probably about the grocery list or something like this.
No. It's she works as my project manager, so it was a question about she's doing a systematic lit review for me on the riskiness of different types of gambling.
Okay.
Should get her on.
Anyway, so the economic impacts of the casinos in Massachusetts were unusual because the operators really were held to their promises to the communities to hire locally and to spend on goods and services locally, which meant that, sort of a lot of the money that the casinos made was actually reinvested or spread out through the communities rather than just going to a large multinational.
There was a study done or something that was proven in the UK. I'm going to ramble on for a minute here, so bear with me. Somebody did a study in the UK and they concluded that for every pound that like a local authority spends locally, if they spend it with a local business, something like 70 pence of that pound stays in the local community. Mm-hmm. Because that local business spends it with local businesses, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. And this happened in a place called Preston, which is Cheshire-ish, I think. I've never been there, famous football team. And Preston Council, some bright spark there, thought we can make our council money work much harder for the community if we are smart in how we do our contracts for like school dinners. Mm-hmm. Because school dinners contract is a big deal. I mean, it's a lot of money, it's a lot of work, and they go out to companies like Brake Brothers and all these, who I'm sure are perfectly competent and who have shareholders and who want to deliver the cheapest possible meal they can. And they found that no local businesses could work on the scale that the schools needed, but that lots of them could do individual jobs. And so they broke down the contracts so that they could all go to local businesses. And the impact on the local community was absolutely profound. But there's also this, the chap I was talking to a while ago, who's one of my heroes in the casino industry. He's the head of custodial services at, I think it's the Chumash Casino in California. Mm. He has basically got that casino's, it might be the same in Massachusetts, I'm not sure. In California, there is a landfill tax. Mm. So if it's a commercial a business, the rubbish that they send to, that's collected, they have to pay. So they pay for the dumpster. They pay for the dumpster hire. They pay for the dumpster collection. And they pay for the dumpster to be emptied in landfill. And it's a lot of money. Because casinos and casino resorts, such as what you have in Massachusetts, generate an extraordinary amount of very varied waste. And what this chap has done, this chap called Mark Funkhauser, he has cut their waste to landfill to less than 4% of their output. And they've done that by going to local recycling groups and saying, actually, we have all of this, could you handle this, can you do, and helping them to develop to get to a point where they can handle this stuff, so stuff is getting, things like coffee grounds and things are being recycled and reused.
Oh yeah, very good on the garden.
Absolutely, slugs hate that shit. But it's just like with some creative thinking, and you see this in native casinos, especially in the US, with creative thinking, the casino can be a colossal driver for good and for growth and for development in the community. If the money isn't just sucked out and distributed to shareholders, but hey, what do I know? I'm just a filthy communist.
You're preaching to the choir here, John.
There are so many good examples, though, already in the US of this happening. One of my questions that I had a note for was, did they have to hire locally? Because the economic impact is very different when they have to do that.
Yeah, because what that means is that the people who are local and are hired have less distance to travel to get to the property. And when they receive their wages or their salaries or whatever, that money then multiplies out into the community because people live there and pay mortgages and, you know, buy groceries and do all kinds of local stuff. So
the training aspect as well, and the opportunity for personal progression, and because there are loads of licensed jobs in the casino as well. Mm-hmm. You know, these aren't unskilled jobs.
No, some of them are highly skilled. And I mean, MGM, it was unusual. MGM was facing a bit of a backlash early on because the local restaurant owners association was like, you're going to hire every line cook that we have in the entire city of Springfield, and we're going to have to train all new line cooks. And so MGM actually helped fund a culinary arts school. So, you know, to sort of beef up the availability of line cooks in the area.
That's, you know, if there's a shortage or you're going to create a shortage, create your own pipeline. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you've got the resources, that's just common sense, but wonderful for the local community because you have a way to create skilled work for, yeah, it's, I hear you.
Yeah, it's thousands of jobs.
It really is. You mentioned that you started gambling research in 1985. Now, this is kind of, I could come at you with two questions, or I could just join them into one rambling mess. What were you working on in 1985? What sucked you into it? I mean, was it just something you saw and you just thought, oh, that's interesting? What kind of inspired that path? And what were the first things you were looking at?
I got a paying job evaluating one of the first treatment programs for problem gambling in the country. And it was funded on a demonstration basis by the state of New York. And so I had moved to Albany about a year before. So in 1984, I took a technical writing job with a little software startup company that 6 months later declared bankruptcy and sent us all to the unemployment office. And so I didn't have enough money to like move back to California, which is where I'd come from. So I started looking around locally for a job for a PhD sociologist with a minor in program evaluation. And I was hired by the head of the research bureau at the Office of Mental Health to evaluate this demonstration program that had been set up by the state legislature. And to be honest, my first or second day on the job, I was handed a 2-page bibliography and told that this is everything that's been published about your topic. You know, it was pathological gambling at that time. This is everything that's been published about pathological gambling. And I looked at this double spaced 2 pages of literature and thought, wow, the state of New York is spending $750,000 a year, and this is all we know about gambling problems. There might be some work here. So I did, in the course of that evaluation, I did my first prevalence survey. And I was very fortunate that Henry Lesier, whose name may be familiar to you as the developer of the South Oaks gambling screen, had just finished the validation work for that measure. And I reached out to him and asked if he would let us use it in our survey in New York. So the New York survey in 1986 was the first time that a validated problem gambling screen was included in a prevalent survey. And yeah, then it went from there. I got funding from NIH in 1988 to replicate what we had found in New York in 5 additional states. And in 1988, when the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act was passed, suddenly almost every state in the country was looking at the possibility that they would have tribal casinos. And so quite a number of states decided to legalize commercial casinos as well as establishing compacts with the tribes. And about a year later, many, many states came calling. In subsequent years, many states came calling, asking for a prevalence survey because they were hearing from their constituents that there were a lot of people experiencing problems with the commercial casinos, with the tribal casinos, et cetera. And so I just went from prevalence survey to prevalence survey to prevalence survey. And at this point, I think I counted it up a year or two ago. I think I have more than 70 prevalence surveys that I've done over my career.
And they're a controversial thing, it turns out. I do have to just go backtrack just a little bit. You said the NIH asked you to do some more. What's the NIH?
The National Institutes of Health.
Great, thank you. So I thought it might be, but I didn't want to assume.
Yeah, that's the federal body that funds all kinds of research in different areas. But interestingly, they don't fund research in the gambling area. There's no National Institute of Gambling Research because all of the issues having to do with gambling in the United States, or almost all the issues having to do with gambling in the United States, are dealt with at the state level.
And Rachel, about the prevalence, I mean, it's an extremely interesting topic, and lots of decisions, you know, policies are leaning on prevalence, and every paper I write, you know, I have to cite prevalence, of course. And the latest one, I think, is from TRAN, isn't it? Like a meta study. And what I always notice is there is no nationwide US prevalence study, is it? Like it's not there, right? Like in the UK, the UK Gambling Commission commissions, you know, the annual prevalence study. Yeah, John, don't frown here. I mean, at least something is happening, okay? But, I mean, the US do not, and many other countries do not. So I would say it's rather rare that a country, you know, runs a prevalence study annually or biannually. But in the US, it's more like then probably state by state, or how does that work?
Oh, it's very much state by state, and it's very dependent on whether in their enabling legislation, the legislators have built in a funding source for problem gambling services that includes research. That was one thing that was very unusual about the legislation in Massachusetts, was that it actually included a mechanism for funding services for problem gamblers, and specified that research had to be conducted annually in Massachusetts.
I think they have that in Mississippi now, don't they?
Really?
No, I mean in Tennessee, because at the UNLV conference, I noticed a number of speakers from Memphis, and they told me that their university receives funding from the online casinos. So the online casinos have to pay like a percentage, which goes into research.
Yeah. It's there's a sort of a increasing number of states that have funded services. A lot of them have set aside 2% of tax revenue received for those services. But in 2022, we did a report that analyzed all of the 32 states that had legalized sports betting at that time to figure out, you know, what their tax structure looked like, what their, what was built into their legislation. And out of those 32 states, only 14 of them, I believe, had provided any kind of funding for services. And only four of them had provided for research in addition to treatment and prevention services.
When you mention sports betting, you are talking about land-based sports betting.
No, land-based and online.
Oh, land online, okay.
Yeah, in fact, more online than land-based.
So what do you think now? I mean, I'm not probably, you know, jumping a bit between the topics, but if you compare, if you look at the, I'm sure you have a good idea about the US online casino and sports betting environment and compared to the European one. And, you know, when you look at the US regulations and the European regulations, they are quite different, right? So in the US, it's pretty loose, I'd say, in terms of, you know, RG features, you know, thresholds. I saw you also published, I think, or involved in a couple of papers about the lower risk gambling thresholds and mm-hmm. those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And what I noticed is when I published my latest paper where I compared US, Canadian, German, Dutch, UK players, that in very few US states, I don't know if in any, I think in none, players have to set limits, right? I mean, there are limits, so operators can provide them limits, but players are not, you know, it's not mandatory for them to set whatever this limit might be, right?
Yeah, no, there's no state in the US that mandates limit setting. In Massachusetts, the sports betting operators are required by statute to offer the opportunity
offer,
to set
yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But until they make it mandatory, it's going to be fairly low uptake. Mm.
And that, I mean, that's often then, you know, used as a way to argue RG doesn't work, you know, like, okay, you know, people don't use RG tools, but we very well know is if you advertise them in, you know, in you nudge players, then they take up, you know, these RG tools. But if you, whatever, hide it somewhere in a very remote area of your website, you know, people will not even notice, you know, they have no idea that this option is even there.
Yeah, we actually are in the middle of, or not middle of yet. We started a couple months ago a study for the Massachusetts Gaming Commission on the use of play management tools like deposit and wager size. You know, setting mm-hmm. various kinds of limits. So you know, there is a lot of interest at the regulator level in Massachusetts about, you know, how to improve that uptake, how to get people who think those tools are just for problem gamblers or for somebody who's got a problem, they're not for me, to make it more normative for people to, you know, to set limits, because it's a proven effective way to keep people out of harm.
Absolutely.
You mentioned how in the US it is state by state how gambling issues are dealt with, and that's something that we come across time and again recording this podcast. I find it when I'm writing articles or whatever, and it seems a little odd, I think, to most Europeans, because not just because, you know, most of us grown up with the framework of the European Union, which works in a federal fashion. Mm-hmm. But it's the, and again, I am not dissing Americans or America when I say this, but it seems like that there's this innate pushback to any kind of regulatory control in anything. I mean, even in the pharmaceutical industry, because I've seen your pharmaceutical adverts and they are hilarious. A tenth of the advert is explaining what the product does. The other 9/10 is saying side effects may include. But it's, this sort of innate pushback over any kind of control. But I can't help thinking how much simpler life would be for everybody. And I'm not just talking about the gambling industry. I'm talking about problem gamblers. If there were an overarching federal framework, both for regulation, because then you wouldn't have the states that have been hoodwinked on their taxes the way that they have been, because some states are hardly seeing any tax because they didn't think that one through. But you wouldn't be seeing that. But also you would have a framework that anybody going into a state will know, look, this is the absolute baseline. This is what's going to go into player protection. This is what's going to go into research. And, you know, anything that the state wants to do over and above that, great, knock yourself out. But this is the absolute basics that you have to do because we can prove that this works. Because we are talking about problems and technologies and businesses that are all mature. We're not talking about new things here. And the rest of the world, we've already made our mistakes with most of this. We've already gotten most of this wrong.
I keep telling folks in the U.S., you know, we are late to the game, so we should try and learn, you know, learn lessons from the mistakes people made in Europe, the mistakes people made in Australia, New Zealand.
There is something that I've come back to, and I know, I'm sorry, Mike, I have mentioned this a couple of times on this podcast and on the other podcast that I host, that the U.S. has a unique frailty, and that is the nature of college sports, because there's no other country in the world that covers college sports the way they're covered in the US. And in fact, in every other country in the world, the people playing college sports are legally adults as well. And there is definitely, again, I'm not dissing America when I say this, there is a huge difference between a European 18-year-old and an American 18-year-old. There's a huge, huge difference. And it's kind of, you have this, I described it as a frailty. It's not the best word I could have used. But it is a unique problem, because the athletes are getting hassled from the public. The public are able to bet on games that in any other country you wouldn't be able to go anywhere near. You can bet on pro sports and that's it. And it's such an unusual thing that had there been, say, for example, I don't know, some kind of federal framework that you could work from, then all of those issues that the professional leagues are just starting to deal with now, and that the colleges and that the college leagues are just starting to deal with now, would have been recognized at the start of this, not 5 years down the line, you know?
Yeah.
It's just something that's been annoying me for years now.
Yeah, it is a peculiar thing. And I mean, you know, the University of Massachusetts Amherst has a very, very large athletic program, and we are only just now beginning to sort of break through to them in terms of, you know, you need to have a conversation with your athletes about gambling that's not, don't do it. Because you'll lose your scholarship. That's not going to be enough for some people.
But also that people might bet on you.
Yeah.
They might know where you go to school.
Yeah.
Do you know, I mean, that must be terrifying for, like, you know, we're talking about kids of, and I don't mean kids in a disparaging way, but, you know, 18, 19, 20 years old. Yeah. It's like, anyway, what do I know? I don't even have hair.
I mean, Rachel, in terms of prevalence, there's lots of discussion about, you know, increased problem gambling after the introduction of online sports betting, online casino gambling. Did you see that in your prevalence studies in the U.S.?
You know, the challenge with the prevalence surveys that I've done recently, apart from Massachusetts, is that there were never baseline surveys done. So you don't know, you know, you have a cross-sectional result and it's like, oh, you know, 2% have gambling problems and another 8% have, you know, are at risk.
Yeah.
You know, and that represents a certain number of people. But if you don't know what it was before the activities started and became available to people, it's very hard to say, you know, what the impact was. Mm-hmm. So that was what was unique about the Massachusetts study of casinos, was that we did a baseline survey before they even announced where the licenses were going to be awarded. So we had gambling data from 2013. We had targeted surveys in the host communities, a number of them. And then in 2021, we had to wait until COVID eased up a little bit. But we did a follow-up general population survey in 2021, which actually showed, because of the pandemic, we actually found that there were quite a much smaller proportion of adults in Massachusetts were gambling in the past year in 2021 compared to 2013. But what was interesting was there was no change in the proportion of adults that were gambling on sports. So there was already, in 2013, there was already about 12% of adults in Massachusetts who gambled on sports. And then in 2021, it was about the same.
But although there was no legal sports betting
not in 2013. And in 2021, there was a lot of conversation about sports betting because legalization or the legislative work was ongoing. But that Sports Betting Act didn't pass until, I want to say, August of 2022. So our 2021 survey even was a a baseline survey that can be compared to future surveys done in Massachusetts.
Interesting. So what would that tell us, like people who, you know, endorse the activity, do it anyway when you introduce?
Well, and sports betting has a very, very long history in the United States. Sports betting has been legal in Nevada since the 1930s. But the amount of informal betting on sports that goes on and went on prior to the legal, you know, prior to the rapid spread of commercial sports betting, you know, there were always people who were betting on sports. I'm sure the same is true in Europe. But you guys, you know, went into a regulated regime quite a bit earlier than anyone in the US.
Yeah, in fact, I think in the UK we probably had a regulated regime before the US was a thing.
Quite possibly. Thinking 16 months.
But it does mean that, you know, to the greater proportion of the UK, sports betting's like, so what? It's like drinking wine to a Frenchman, you know?
Yeah, I mean, one of the shocks of my life was having spent 2 years in boarding school in Switzerland and, you know, going to the cafes, drinking wine with my friends, blah, blah, blah. I came through New York on my way to meet up with my family. And I walked into a bar at JFK, the main airport in New York, and ordered a glass of wine. And the guy's like, let me see your ID. And I'm like, oh. And I gave him my ID. He says, you can't drink. You can't even be in this bar. You're underage. And I'm like, what? I've been drinking for 2 years. Come on now.
Yeah, come on. Just give me a little something to take the edge off.
Yeah, right? It's been an 8-hour flight. Goodness sake.
Don't bum me out, man. Honestly, it would have worked. So you've been doing gambling research for like 40 years, right?
41.
So you, it's fair to say, you've seen things.
Oh, I've probably forgotten more than I have seen a lot. You know, when I started in this field, there were only two states that had casino gambling, which was Nevada and New Jersey in Atlantic City. I believe it was 28 or 30 states that had state lotteries. Now, a lot of states had charitable gambling, you know, like pop-up casino nights, things like that. And horse racing was quite a thing in many states in the U.S. But I watched, the expansion of lotteries and sort of, you know, like the many different products that started looking more and more like paper slot machines. I watched and observed and wrote about casino gambling in the United States for quite a long time in the wake of the passing of the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act. And then I had a period of time where I was doing a lot of international work in Sweden and Britain and Australia and New Zealand, where we were doing what are called cohort studies, where you enlist or you recruit a group of people and you re-interview them on a regular basis over a number of years to figure out, you know, how their behavior changes over time. Because one of the first things that I learned when we started looking at how the Southwest gambling screen performed was, this is from a survey that we did in New Zealand, where we followed up everyone who had been classified as a problem gambler in the prevalence survey. We followed up with them 6 months later to see how they were doing. And to our complete shock, only about a third of them would still be classified as problem gamblers. And the rest of them were, you know, sort of doing less gambling or not gambling at all. And none of them had sought help from a professional treatment person because those services didn't exist in New Zealand at that time.
I mean, how'd that work? What did they do right?
Well, a lot of them, if you think about, you know, once burned, twice shy, a lot of people learn from a bad experience that they really shouldn't be gambling at the level that they're gambling at. And the vast majority of people who experience gambling problems never seek professional help for that issue. But a lot of them, you know, do sort of manage to get friends and family to help them out by controlling their access to their money. Friends and family, clergy, you know, people do a lot of things, but mostly they cut back. And that seems to help them. But it's always been interesting to me how few problem gamblers actually seek help for that issue.
Would you say that's true for the entire spectrum of problem gambling, you know, like pathological gamblers or, you know, let's say if there were comorbidities? Because ultimately, I mean, it comes down to definition, doesn't it? You mentioned the South Oaks gambling screen a number of times. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have the PGSI, you have the light bet, whatever. I mean, the concept of, it's a concept, right? Problem gambling. I mean, it's not something that you can, identify in a person's blood or in a brain scan or something like that.
That's true. There's no breathalyzer test for problem gambling. I've been pretty heavily involved in developing valid and reliable measures of problem gambling and of gambling behavior in general. But all of those measures are screens. They are not diagnoses. And so, you know, a diagnosis is something that you get in a clinician's office. And until 2013, they would have been using the DSM-4. In 2013, when the DSM-5 came out, you know, presumably clinicians were switching and to their measures or their diagnostic tools to reflect changes in that diagnosis. But I've been engaged for many years in trying to increase the likelihood that clinicians who are treating people with drug problems or alcohol problems or depression or anxiety, you know, they should be screening for gambling problems, because people with those disorders very often have comorbid gambling issues. Mm.
What's interesting is, so only a few papers have assessed, have collected, you know, PGSI or similar screens among real-world online gamblers, right? So most of the studies are, you know, it's the population, many of them, you know, don't really gamble at all. But in a real sort of, you know, online casino setting like Merge, you know, with data from Lotto Quebec, which is an online casino. I mean, it's a lottery, but they also have the online casino. I published like 3 studies, and they all, I mean, all of those studies pretty much report like 20% of the ones who have been gambling actually score 8+ on the PGSI, right? So it's actually a pretty large number. Mm-hmm. And let's say if they were to, whatever, you know, block or suspend, you know, problem gamblers, that would sort of, you know, cut either way a significant amount of their revenue.
Oh,
so then some argue then, okay, I mean, you know, those screens are all too, the opposite of, you know, conservative, progress, you know, they identify too many false positives, right? The thresholds are too low. You know, you easily score 8+, but you're not really a problem gambler, whatever a problem gambler is. So what do you think? I mean,
so let me get into my geek mode. The issue that we've sort of had with measuring gambling problems amongst people are multiple. So there's the issue that quite a few of these screens don't work very well in terms of identifying true problem gamblers. There's also the criticism that is often made that you're relying on people accurately recalling their behavior over the past year. And the question I used to get all the time was, you know, I would say, oh, you know, I do surveys of gambling problems, and people would be like, oh, don't they lie to you all the time?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Mm.
You know, people don't necessarily lie, but they can have difficulties accurately answering a question based on, you know, something like, here's a good question. What do you spend on groceries every week?
Absolutely, yeah, sure. I mean, we know, I mean, that if you look at, you know, Sally's studies, or I also published 2, when we compare, as you know, subject self-reported gambling spending with real gambling spending, that, you know, especially like when you ask somebody about betting, you know, in casino gambling, you have no idea how much you actually bet. I mean, you can deposit $100, but ultimately you accumulated bets of 1,000, you know, and you lost whatever, you know, 950. It's extremely bad, bad outcome variable to ask somebody for.
Yeah. So, you know, I have a close colleague, Rob Williams, who I've worked with very closely since 2007. And Rob and I developed a measure that we called, unfortunately, at the time, we called it the Problem and Pathological Gambling Measure, the PPGM. And what makes the PPGM unique is that it's not a simple additive score. It's not that you answer question one, question two, question five, and question nine, and then you get a score. The PPGM requires that you score at least one amongst a set of items that assess whether you have a sense of control over your gambling behavior, and a separate set of items, so a separate scale that tries to figure out, tries to figure out whether you're experiencing harms related to your gambling.
Yeah, okay.
You can't be classified as a problem gambler on the PPGM unless you have items in both of those categories.
Yeah, makes sense. I mean, that's, you know, like in my line of work, so I discuss with online gambling operators often the issue of what are they actually supposed to identify, right? You know, I mean, that sort of, you know, my expertise is, you know, applying machine learning algorithms to identify problem gambling based on somebody's gambling, blah, 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 right? So, and then it often comes down to very regularly that these online gambling operators are about, okay, you know, how valid is your prediction, you know? And I mean, okay, then it comes down to what are we actually trying to predict here, right? Okay, do we, you know, collect PGSI, and we train an algorithm based on, you know, the PGSI responses, but then very often the regulators actually ask for something else, right? Because most regulation is actually about preventing somebody from losing more money than they have, but that doesn't necessarily overlap with the problem gambling, because somebody can, you know, have the funds available, they gamble, okay, it might sort of, you know, harm them socially or whatever, but they can do it, but they would sort of meet criteria of problem gambling. On the other hand, very often you see that problem gamblers are the ones who spend very little, right? They spend $200 a month, their, you know, social benefits, whatever. And they are, you know, in these online casino operators, sort of, you know, customer relationship matrix somewhere, you know, at the very bottom. So I think what's really lacking is, something like you just mentioned, right? Something that's not just additive, okay, but which also takes into account, you know, financial aspects. Are they harmed by their gambling in any way?
Yeah, and, you know, there's a lot of work that was done in Australia looking at gambling harms. And I'm very much in favor of understanding that it's not just people who could be classified as problem gamblers who are experiencing gambling harm. It's a much broader spectrum than that. And, you know, so it's not that you've got, you know, 1% or 2% of the population that's classified as problem gamblers. It's that you've got, you know, 10% of the population that's experienced one or more harms, whether it's financial harm or relationship harm or, you know, impacts on their physical health, their mental health, work and school impacts. All of those are sort of pieces of the puzzle that you have to take into consideration when you're considering what the impacts, social and economic, are of the introduction of a new form of gambling.
Yeah, just like we're sort of, you know, over time already, but I just wanted quickly to come back on the lotteries, because you mentioned before that when you started, there were a few lotteries, then, you know, more and more. And what I, you know, see is that many lotteries also introduce games, which, I mean, lottery is just a name, isn't it? I mean, it's just, okay, but ultimately it's games of chance and they have certain structural characteristics, and we call some of them lotteries, right? We call some of them casino, but in reality, those games are just, you know, they have a certain structure, and, you know, it's, you know, I mean, I don't call it slot, or I don't call it this, I don't call it that. I mean, it's a, you know, mathematical concept, and which the majority is random or fully random. And I see that lotteries also increasingly introduce games that, you know, have like a high event frequency, for example, etc., that, you know, then are very similar to the slots. So do you also experience that movement?
Oh, yeah. I remember quite early on, where was I? So this was just before the instant ticket, you know, scratchers.
Yeah.
Before the instant ticket market exploded. I was on a business trip, I think it was Minnesota, and I walked into the bar at the restaurant or the bar at the hotel, and there was this big jar of what they call pull tabs. And you could buy, you know, 5 or 10 pull tabs. And I watched some guy go through $100 worth of, you know, like these 50-cent pull tabs, and he would just rip them up and throw them on the floor, rip them up, throw them on the floor, rip them up. He was looking for a winner. And I thought, wow, that looks like a slot machine.
Like
hitting the button. And I was really taken aback to realize that those tip jars, they're called, with the pull tabs in them, they were everywhere. Well, they're nowhere in Minnesota any longer, or they might still be somewhere in the U.S., but I haven't seen them in a long time. But, you know,
I think they're in Alaska.
Maybe. But,
no, they are.
Really? You know,
lotteries started out with just those large jackpots.
Yeah.
So, you know, you bought your ticket or your number, and you had to wait a week to find out if you won or lost anything. And the lotteries sort of gradually moved from, you know, sort of those large jackpots to, you know, daily numbers games. But then when the instant tickets became possible and became available, that really is, for most lotteries, the instant tickets are their money machine, and the other stuff is just kind of icing on the cake.
Of course, I mean, you know, the more often you can play and, you know, instantly receive your potential reward, the more interesting it becomes. I mean, it's similar. It's the same with TikTok, Instagram. You know, I mean, the more frequently you can receive something, the novelty aspect is what drives it.
Yeah. So lotteries have changed a lot. We just had here in Massachusetts, the lottery had tried for years to be allowed to offer lottery tickets online. What you may not know about Massachusetts is that we have the most successful, profitable lottery in the country and possibly in the world. But we also have the highest per capita spending on lottery tickets. I think the last number I saw was the average spend by a Massachusetts adult on lottery products was somewhere around $800 or $900 US, which is like, wait a minute, who's buying all those tickets? Because I'm not buying them. I live in Massachusetts. But the Massachusetts lottery had tried for years and years to be allowed to offer online games. And it was only when sports betting passed that the state legislature finally said, okay, we're going to have to let the lottery be competitive because there's all these sports betting online operators. And so it was just a couple of weeks ago at the end of July that the Massachusetts Lottery finally launched its online lottery. So you can, buy instant tickets online.
I hope with a lot of Archie measures into it.
Oh yeah. That was one of the things I was very relieved to see, is that I won't pull it up right now, but it was clear to me that the Gaming Commission had worked very closely with the Lottery Commission to make sure that all of the RG tools that they require of their casino and sports betting operators were included with the online lottery piece.
Just one little thing about that pull tabs that you were talking about. There's that thing that makes pull tabs different, which is really fascinating. Psychologically, it's really fascinating. And it's the same with scratch cards when you play them online, I think. Because usually at the point where you buy a pull tab, you know how many tickets are still in circulation and what jackpots are still to be won, which is, of course, what lottery sites show you when you are buying scratch cards. There are X because there's a limited number of tickets for this particular draw, and there are still two jackpots out there, and it's all part of that appeal. But I'd be fascinated if somebody's, like I say, I'm pretty sure you still do pull tabs in Alaska. I'd be fascinated if somebody's done research on how the purchasing patterns change with the publication of statistics in physical purchasing, not in online purchasing, in physical purchasing. Like, if say there's a draw and there's 5,000 tickets for it, you might go, do you know what? I've got a couple of dollars in my pocket. I'll just have a go. But if out of those 5,000 tickets, there's 980 left and the jackpot hasn't been won, you're going to shop very differently. And of course, the odds have changed.
Yeah. In a very real way.
Unlike when you see casino gaming, I went with a friend to a casino years ago. She'd never been to a casino. And I was explaining to her how the billboard signage on the roulette works. Like, it's not doing anything underhand as such. It's just presenting some information that is actually completely useless.
Yeah.
You do with it whatever you feel like doing with it.
Yeah.
It's letting your brain do what your brain is going to do naturally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Brains are very interested in uncertainty.
And patterns.
Yeah, we can't handle it.
Yeah.
Everything has to, have a reason.
Yeah, but that's not my area of expertise. I think it's very interesting, neurologically and psychologically, but I've never felt confident about plunging into those areas because as soon as you say brain science, my brain turns to mush.
Mine does that with most subjects, unfortunately. Rachel, I will draw that to a close there. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been an absolute pleasure. I kind of feel like we've just scratched the surface.
Well, thank you, Rachel. Talking to someone with 40 years of experience.
It's like we could just do an episode just about the Massachusetts study and just talk about nothing else.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
$17.5 million later, we found out a lot of stuff.
I mean, It should fill at least one podcast episode.
Yeah, we might have to have you back if you're willing to put up with us again.